Station number 12389, this is East Spiegelberg, Reel 2.
Eldora Spiegelberg, Reel 2. How important do you think the media was in the Vietnam War? You know, am I right in thinking you were able to get a lot of information on what was actually going on there?
Yes, a lot more information than we certainly got in the Gulf War. We had lots of very good journalists right on the site, and pictures kept pouring in through the newspapers. The picture that mobilized the most sympathy was this child running along the road naked and burning with phosphorescent whatever it was that they had poured upon the child's body. And then, of course, the Malay massacre, where this whole village was massacred by American soldiers for no good reason. And there were dreadful pictures of that massacre. And we saw the war on television every night, so that it was quite different than the carefully monitored war that has just passed. And we got firsthand reports from our own people who would go over there. They were allowed to circulate quite freely and gather their own information. And so we were just heavily involved through the media, really, quite in a quite different way than we have been in this last war. And that was very important. You know, when you see every night something about the war, even though the State Department's interpretation was given for the reasons and so on, there was enough there to make it quite evident that a small and agricultural people were being overwhelmed by our big war machine.
Did you have any connection also with soldiers who were returning from the war? You know, were you giving counseling or getting information from troops who'd been to Vietnam?
No, not at all. We didn't. If they came back during the war, they certainly kept completely away from us. And I must say that we were very unsympathetic on the whole towards the men who fought in Vietnam. We realize now that that was wrong and that they were not to blame for being forced into that war, and that many of them didn't want to do what they had to do when they got there. But it was just a feeling of not wanting to have anything to do with those who we felt had perpetrated crimes, war crimes, on these people. And I guess that was not a very constructive viewpoint, but that's how we felt.
This support, you know, you've described so well your missions to Washington and how thousands would assemble there. Can you remember, was there any point, was there any one thing in the war where it became easier to mobilize people, or was it a sort of more steady thing?
Well, I think it was the so-called Tet Offensive, when Nixon ordered ordered a tremendous bombing of North Vietnam that somehow really was the peak of our protest. And then, of course, the incursion into Cambodia was simply unbelievable. Here was a neutral country which was being used on its border by the Vietnamese, but the country itself had been completely peaceful. And for us to go in there and start to bomb Cambodia too just was more than we could stand. I think maybe either the Tet or the Cambodian bombing really got everybody to the boiling point.
Yes. Am I right in thinking that Watergate would have happened during the Vietnam War? Was that during that time?
I guess so.
Yes. I wonder if that was sort of part and parcel of this public attitude.
Well, yes, it was. I'm a little vague about just when Watergate happened, but there was a feeling that our government was so corrupt, and this breaking into the headquarters of the, was it the Democratic Party by the Republicans and so on, was just part of the whole sleazy operation of the government. It was a very terrible time to be an American, really. So,
yes, and getting the support at local level, you know, for your missions to Washington, your demonstrations, how did you go about that? You know, if I can look at the sort of detail of it, when you were planning a big demonstration in Washington, how would your group go about attracting people at local level?
Oh, we had a coalition formed of all the peace groups, all the religious bodies, and the American Friends Service Committee. And we met, our headquarters were the Peace Information Center. We had a strong student group, too. And this coalition met constantly, I guess every week. And when a mobilization was declared for the whole country, we were all set because we reached into every group and every congregation in the city. And all we needed to do was send the word, and every group used their own leaflets, their own newsletters, and telephone alerts and so on to let their groups know about it. And we would hire the buses and negotiate prices and places where all the buses would start and bring in people from the rural areas around St. Louis and so on. So it was very well organized throughout the Vietnam War. There were certain leaders who had quite a lot of influence in St. Louis. For instance, Dr. Barry Commoner was a very great influence in the academic group. There were teach-ins constantly at the universities at which professors and so on would talk with the students and give them information about what was going on in Vietnam. And it was, we've never since had anything like this total coordination in the community against anything as we did against the Vietnam War.
Would you say that all social classes, I mean, perhaps it's this sort of demonstrates my Englishness, that I think in terms of social class, you know, but would you say that all different types of people, working people, farming people, were they all represented in this protest movement, or was it more a sort of intellectual group?
I guess one would have to say that it was mostly the preponderance of people were well-educated, white, upper-middle-class people. We always had trouble getting real support from the black community, because then, as now, the military was one place where young men who had no jobs and no hope for the future at least felt that they might be able to function and have get some recognition and so on. So we did hold many joint things downtown with the black people, but it was never as pronounced with them as it was with the white intellectuals. And as far as rural people were concerned, probably they were the least involved and the least instructed in the whole thing, didn't understand what was going on. So it is sort of a matter of class, even in the United States, unfortunately.
How about fundraising? You know, did you have to raise quite a lot of funds for these sort of trips to Washington and other things?
Oh, yes. We always did. We always had scholarships for people who couldn't pay the trip, the tickets. We did a lot of that. In fact, when you ask about fundraising, I should remember that, because we had our famous candlelight dinners, a whole series of these where the women in the peace movement cooked all the food according to an agreed upon menu, and we would serve the really lovely banquets in a certain church downtown, midway between the city and the county, a church which happened to be very hospitable to the movement. And then it would be followed, the banquet would be followed by a concert by the so-called Musicians for Peace, who were members of the St. Louis Symphony, who gave their services gratis for these concerts. And we would raise a lot of money through this series of banquets and concerts. We did several of those. Yes, fundraising was a very important part of it.
How about conscientious objectors, you know, during the Vietnam War? When you look back at this time and your experience of it, how do you think they were treated by the United States government?
On the whole, I think they were treated pretty well. It's the first time that conscientious objection was defined as being accorded to people who had an ethical or moral objection to war, and not just those who believed in a supreme being. So this widened the possibility for conscientious objection, and there were, interestingly enough, we knew which boards were liberal and which ones were conservative, and it was very hard to get conscientious objector status from certain boards and easier to get it from others. And we would interview the members of these boards and send them telegrams and phone them and beg them to grant conscientious objector status to young men who appeared before them and so on. This was a large part of our activity. A few of us managed to actually get ourselves onto those boards, but that wasn't very common.
Did you participate, for instance?
Well, I never was on a board, but I counseled in the center.
Did you find that many of the young, these would have been all young men, am I right in thinking that?
Yes, yes, there were no women at that time.
Did they suffer dilemmas, you know, about their objection?
Yes, but less so, I think, than in almost any other war. I mean, they were so clear in their minds that this particular war was one that they just could not imagine fighting in. So they would do anything to get out of it. And, of course, there was a lot of student deferment and deferment of, well, of theologians, theological students, and so on, all of which was rather unfair, maybe, to the others. But everyone used every possible ploy to not appear, you know, and not have to serve.
Were any sent to prison for that war that you know?
Yes, I think quite a few of them were. Some of them simply refused. There were absolute objectors who refused to avail themselves, let's say, of the possibilities that opened up to them and simply made a public stand of their conscientious objection on purpose. And they were imprisoned, and they just strengthened the movement.
I think I'd like to ask you now about the Gulf War, you know, because you have compared it very interestingly, I think, the differences. But before I do that, you mentioned earlier Japanese, you know, the situation of the Japanese related to another topic. But I wondered if you knew anything about and felt anything about the way Japanese were treated in World War II.
Oh, yes. I was teaching the deaf in Pittsburgh at that time. And I wasn't a friend yet, a Quaker, but I got a lot of information about the situation in the camps, and I was able to set up a correspondence between my deaf Sunday school children and children in one of the Japanese camps. And I was just horrified at the idea that these people were deprived of their freedom and had all their belongings sold off and so on, when there was no shred of real evidence that they were traitors or had done anything to further the Japanese cause. So all of us, at that time I wasn't part of a real peace movement except this Youth Committee Against War, which I mentioned, which then became the Youth Committee for Democracy. But we attended a very progressive church near the university, and all of us worked very hard to somehow ameliorate the situation of these Japanese. We couldn't stop it, but we talked against what was happening, and we publicized the wrongness of it and so on.
I understand a lot of them were American citizens, you know.
Almost all of them were. It was just incredible. And their children, who spoke with American accents and had gone to American schools from birth and so on, to think that these children were hoarded into these camps. It just didn't seem possible that this could happen in America. But it did. And it shows the depth of our ability to whip up war sentiment if it was needed, and they felt it was needed to get us into the war against Japan.
Was anything like that? did anything like that occur in the Vietnam War? Did you have Vietnamese people in America? You know,
No, we didn't. We had Asians, you know, some Chinese and so on, but not till after the war, when the boat people started coming, did we have actually Vietnamese people in the United States. So that was another thing. Nobody had ever even met a Vietnamese. So how could they hate them and feel that they were our enemies? They either accepted the picture of these gooks, as they were called, and little yellow devils and so on, which the war people tried to conjure up, or else they felt, as we did, that these people were very much like ourselves, but with a different skin. And it was just...
Well, when you think of the boat people, you know, do you think America has done enough for the, the sort of victims of the war? Did America receive many of the boat people?
Yes, I think they did. I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me that since the boat people were escaping from what we perceived as a communist regime, they were received very sympathetically, as were people from all over the world, as long as they claimed that they were escaping from communist persecution. Heaven help them if they were escaping from simply totalitarian persecution by regimes that the United States was backing. Then they were not political people, and they were just coming here supposedly for economic advantage. But the boat people were clearly victims of the communist regime that took over Vietnam. So, yes, I think that they were quite well received.
Could I establish, Eldora, you know, are you a Quaker?
Yes, I am now. My husband and I joined in, I think it was 1966, after we had come to St. Louis. But I had known the Quakers all my life. My father was very fond of them. There was a hostel in Vienna where we always stopped on our furloughs. run by Quakers, and I, as a student or as a teacher of the deaf, my mother and I attended several Quaker institutes, and we felt very much in harmony with Quaker ideals. And before my husband and I were able to join a group, because there were none in Appleton, we were members of the wider Quaker Fellowship, which is set up for people who want to stay in their denominations but sympathize with the views of the Quakers.
And does this come into your the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom? You know, is there a big Quaker group in that, or is it a Quaker group?
Well, no, it isn't a Quaker group, but it happens that many of the people, the women who have headed it, have been Quakers. And Jane Addams herself was not a Quaker, though her father was a great sympathizer. And she has often been identified as a Quaker, but she was not. But our international and national presidents have almost always been Quakers, and we have always used the consensus method of reaching decisions, even in our large bodies at our congresses. And we have, there is a lot of, has permeated into the Women's International League of the Quaker spirit, especially, of course, our complete devotion to disarmament and to specially get rid of nuclear weapons.
So could I ask you now, because you know, we are very interested in this League of Peace and Freedom, when it was formed, could you tell me about its formation?
Oh, yes. It was formed actually in 1915 when 1,200 women from the warring and neutral countries joined at The Hague for a conference. It had been planned, of course, before war started in 1914, but the women decided to go ahead with it anyway. And even German women came across the borders to The Hague. And Jane Addams led this large delegation from the United States, which just barely got there in time and was held up at the Channel. But they had a wonderful conference, and at the end of it, they pledged to each other that they would remain friends regardless of the politics of their countries. And they divided up into teams of two and went to all the heads of neutral states and begged them to establish a board of mediation to which the warring heads of state could come and negotiate peace even while the war was going on. But this was rejected, even though many of them said that this was a wonderful idea, but they just couldn't bring it about. And Jane Addams went back to the United States and presented it to Wilson, and he agreed that his 14 points, which he presented at Versailles later, were based on the women's suggestions. Well, Jane Addams campaigned for Wilson because he promised to keep the United States out of war, but then he joined, and she stood by her principles. She still opposed the war, and then she was reviled, and the Women's International League, which had become very strong in the United States simply didn't grow very, very fast at that time. But after the war, they had their second Congress in Zurich at the same time that the Versailles Treaty was being hammered out, and they cabled to Versailles and said, "You are sowing the seeds of a Second World War," which was so true. And after, during the period between the two wars, they worked hard for the establishment of the League of Nations and the International Court of Justice.